Welcome to the Philharmonic Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:01 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is February 4th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let me apologise for posting the wrong audio last week. When Sarah contacted me Monday morning, I was standing on the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, and I could have sang through it. I was mortified that I'd made such a terrible mistake. So I will endeavour not to do the same thing this week. This has been a relatively mixed week for stock markets. Generally, it's been relatively firm right across Europe and the USA. And as we approach the close on Wall Street, the Nasdaq has moved to a new recovery high on that Nasdaq 100. So my short position on that isn't looking particularly smart at present. And of course, I was in opening that, I was really only looking for a mean reversion, and that at the moment looks to have been delayed somewhat. It's a somewhat different story in some of those emerging markets, and I'll come to those in a minute. But in Europe, it's also been a relatively steady tone. This has also been a week in which the dollar has rebounded and in quite emphatically against currencies such as the euro, but it's been generally firm for most of the week, and that has weighed on the commodity complex a little bit. There is the increasing risk in commodities that we're going to have some form of intervention by either exchanges or the CFTC or indeed other regulatory bodies, because we're now getting to a stage where particularly food commodities have risen to such an extent that they are becoming a political liability. And that is particularly the case in a number of less developed markets. The political troubles that have been making headlines in the Middle East, particularly in Tunisia, Egypt, and Yemen, have a number of different catalysts, but certainly right up there, front and center, is the fact that food price inflation and youth unemployment have reached pretty unacceptable levels, particularly from the perspective of the populations that are protesting. So that is a bit of a warning light that the chances of some form of intervention in the commodity markets from regulators has certainly increased. And we saw a certain amount of that in the cotton market yesterday, where they have basically changed the rules on the exchange so that anyone holding more than 300 contracts would have to demonstrate that they can fund delivery if they're in the front month contract. And at least That is at least in part aimed at contracting that big backwardation, in other words, the premium of the front month to the second month in the cotton market. And it's already contracted quite a lot. It peaked out just before Christmas on the contract roll at about 13.5 cents. It's currently at 5 cents, but that's still really very wide by historical standards. And while overextended in the short term, cotton remains in a medium-term uptrend, so we won't have any real conclusive evidence that it has encountered a medium-term top until its progression of major reaction lows has been broken, but it certainly hit a peak of at least short-term significance. It was limit down yesterday, having made a new high, forming a Q reversal, and it's limit down again in here today. So that does indicate that the potential for major intervention in the commodity markets can check advances really very quickly. And there are a number of other commodities that are hitting impressive new highs. The coffee market is rock steady in what has been, if perhaps one was to look at very short-term charts, it would look volatile. But when one takes a step back and looks at upwards of 5 to 10 years, it's been a remarkably consistent advance. And that has also been mirrored in perhaps less common commodities such as the rubber market, which has also hit multi-decade new nominal highs and continues to do so. And it's been accelerating for the better part of 6 weeks at this point. So certainly the commodity complex has been really very active in the last few months. And it's not just in the food sector or in the agricultural sector, but it spans right out through industrial commodities and energy. The oil market, the WTI US traded contract is currently trading at 88.98, so it's down a tad in here today, $1.56. The spread between that US contract and Brent remains still very high, and the Brent contract is still over $100. So while oil has really rallied quite spectacularly in the early part of this week, it's not particularly overextended, and we're seeing that commodities tied to the oil complex have all done very well this week, and a number of those uranium miners broke out of little first steps above their basis. We saw a number of solar-related companies are beginning to show relative strength. They are primarily high beta plays on high oil prices, so they don't tend to do very well at all until oil prices start to become a concern, and that's when people start to become interested in renewables again because they're not particularly competitive at low energy prices. The game changer for the energy sector remains natural gas. Natural gas is currently sitting at $4.31, and while we've seen just about all energy commodities doing really quite well over the last few months, natural gas has been absolutely range bound in this $4 to $6 area. And it's becoming increasingly attractive relative to other energy sources, the higher they go relative to what natural gas is doing. And the reason that natural gas has got such limited catch-up potential right now is because supply has exploded in the USA. Shale gas, tight gas, sand gas are all in are come under the heading of unconventional gas. They are not without controversy in the way that they're extracted and the fracking and the various chemicals that are pumped into the ground to facilitate getting them out of this hard rock. But you are looking at something that is changing the energy complex in no uncertain terms, for the simple reason that you have an abundant, relatively clean, cheap, and secure energy source within the USA and Canada that is imminently exploitable. And it is only a matter of time before ideology gives way to economics, because natural gas is a tried and trusted fuel. And the fact that so much additional supply has been found and is now capable of being brought back on, being brought online, that is changing the dynamics of the energy complex, and it changes the economics of a large number of consumers of energy. So now that we have huge amounts of supply of a new energy source, it's only a matter of time before people start to think of new ways to use it. So natural gas is the fuel of the future, and it is competitive at these levels with coal. And that's no meager claim. So we can anticipate that the demand side of natural gas is probably going to go through an exponential shift in the next 10 years. And such has been the explosion in supply through the tapping of unconventional reserves and the increasing build-out of liquefied natural gas terminals, that natural gas supply is likely to be the main fossil fuel for decades to come. And it will put increasing pressure on marginal operations, particularly in the renewable sector, because while they tend to be high beta to high oil prices, the fact that natural gas prices have been depressed, I think, has been largely ignored by investors because they haven't been depressed for particularly long. But the longer that natural gas remains in this base formation, and the longer it takes for the massive amounts of gas in storage to be depleted, the greater the likelihood is that people will really start to take seriously the fact that we've had a major change in the energy complex. So oil remains currently the main fuel of choice for the vast majority of consumers, but we can't anticipate that that's going to remain the case over the long term, certainly over the short term, certainly over the medium term, but over the long term, the chances are that we're going to have a major building out of natural gas infrastructure and indeed uranium infrastructure. You know, the number of uranium terminal or uranium reactors that are being constructed today and that are being planned is a multiple of those that exist in the world today. And that is also helping to fuel the demand for uranium and interest in those uranium shares, which have all broken out of basis in the last few months. The industrial metal complex is also of interest at the moment because copper touched the $10,000 level on the LME this week. Tin remains within a remarkably impressive medium-term uptrend. Nickel is breaking out of what has been a relatively long consolidation, and aluminium is looking primed to do the same. And demand for all of these industrial commodities, demand for energy, demand for all of these agricultural commodities is being made possible by the fact that you have economic growth that is world-beating in some of the major population centers of the world. The expansion of the global middle class, which is being fueled by the fact that so many of these high population economies are growing at rates that are faster than their population growth and helping to expand that middle class. The per capita consumption of commodities is rising and still has quite a way to go before people in these countries begin to consume on a per capita basis what people in Europe and the USA do. So when we look back over history, major commodity bull cycles tend to last for between 10 and 20 years, and we've had this one for about the last 10 years. But back in the 1970s, which was the last major bull cycle in commodities, the commodity consuming population of the world was roughly about 1 billion, whereas the world's population at the moment is about 6 billion, is likely to grow to 7 billion in the not too distant future. And there are literally hundreds of millions of people being lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes in the major population centers of the world, which are China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and the Middle Eastern region, if taken as a single block. And that's going to help to drive the consumption of commodities for a considerable period of time. So far, and I think since 2003, we've referred to the commodity bull cycle as supply inelasticity meets rising demand. And the demand component of that equation is pretty easy to see. The supply inelasticity was exaggerated even more following the credit crisis because the funding necessary for the expansion of supply was restricted, and a good number of projects were cancelled, and that's helped to fuel the price rises in so many of these commodities. As I said at the opening, the potential for some form of intervention in the agricultural commodity sector has increased really quite considerably. And that's not least because the central banks of the world, particularly those that have engaged in quantitative easing, know that they are playing with fire because they were quite safe in expanding the supply of money when the velocity of that money had collapsed during the recession. But we're now into a situation where the global economy has returned to growth and it's being led by the progressing economies in Asia and Latin America. And there are renewed signs of growth in much of Europe and the USA. I posted a chart of m2 multiplied by the velocity of m2 yesterday. And I believe it's really well worth taking a look at for the simple reason that it was a remarkably consistent line from all the way through from the 1960s to 2008, where the supply of money was commensurate with the velocity of money to create a 45 degree angle in the multiple. And that broke down in 2008 with the credit crisis. And central bankers aren't going to be ignorant of that fact, and they've increased the supply of money to really quite extraordinary levels to compensate for the massive decline in the velocity of money. They're going to keep that in the system for a considerable period because the last thing they want is deflation. But with commodity prices surging, they run the risk of the inflationary expectations of populations becoming unhinged, and that's something they're going to combat at every opportunity. But the last thing they want to do is raise interest rates because they still believe that the economic recovery is still too fragile, in which case they're going to legislate. They're going to attempt to talk down the commodity markets, and where they fail to do that, they're going to regulate. So the higher the commodity prices go, the stronger the likelihood is that we're going to have a slew of margin hikes on futures positions, and potentially, and we know that the CFTC is already conducting a 6-month investigation into the role of speculators in the market. That they will be under political pressure to come out with some hard-hitting recommendations. So while all of these agricultural commodities remain in medium-term uptrends, and while some of them are really quite overextended, particularly the grains look like they're going to go higher, but they're not without risk on the upside. Those central bankers are reluctant to allow commodity price inflation to dominate the headlines because they are attempting to do by stealth what everyone assumes that they're going to do in actuality, and that's to inflate away the massive debts that they have taken on over the last few years. The balance sheets of various central banks have exploded over the last few years, and it's simply not realistic to expect them to pay back all that debt. And well, I should say that it's not realistic to expect them to pay back that debt in the currency in which it was issued, because the various dollars and euros that bondholders get paid back aren't going to be worth a fraction of what they were when they were borrowed in the first place. So we are back into an inflationary cycle. The last 20 years have been disinflationary, and particularly China has been able to export deflationary pressures for much of the last 20 years. They had the scale in manufacturing, and we've seen that manufactured goods in particular have fallen in price for a persistent period. But what we're now starting to see is China is beginning to export inflationary pressures because wages are starting to rise. The China is no longer a country that has the cheapest labor in the world, and it's turned the corner, which means that we have reached the bottom in terms of how cheap manufactured goods are going to get. And as inflationary pressures remain a concern in emerging markets, then wage pressures are likely to continue to rise. And that means that we can no longer rely on the competitive forces of globalization to create a disinflationary environment. It's probably going to be quite the opposite going forward. What we've seen in terms of the chart action is that US Treasuries, Treasury yields, have been trending downward since 1980. They looked like they had bottomed back in 2003, and the credit crisis saw them dropping to an even lower low. One of the points that we come to at the chart seminar is that trends often lose their consistency at the penultimate low. And there's a good chance that what we saw in 2003 was the penultimate low. What we've seen recently, there's a much stronger likelihood that it was the low. The major rally in bond prices posted in September did not retest or did not surmount the low in the yields. And we've seen yields rising once more. People are starting to think that if the deflationary hypothesis is no longer a certainty, then treasuries aren't much of a long-term investment, certainly not 30-year treasuries. And that means that the buyer of last resort is the Fed itself. And that can only persist for as long as quantitative easing remains a political reality. And that's certainly not a foregone conclusion, particularly with the US economy beginning to recover once more. So we're likely now on a new inflationary cycle. And we can see evidence of that in the treasury markets, but it's not conclusive. But it's completely conclusive when one looks at inflation-adjusted charts of commodities. And we have a whole section for that in the chart library. And if you look at those over at least 20 years, and in some cases we have over 50 years of data, you'll see that a large number of commodities, particularly the agricultural commodities, have broken 30-year inflation-adjusted downtrends. So they took 30 years to get down to what, in some cases, are the cheapest nominal prices for foods ever. And that's not really an exaggeration. It could be, I could be in my dotage before we see food prices as low as they were before this commodity bull market got going again. We're not going to see food prices getting back up to where they were in the early 70s in the short term, but it's certainly a medium to long term possibility. A rational expectation is that in nominal terms, so many of these commodities have broken out of multi-decade long ranges in nominal terms that they're probably going to find support at the upper side of their ranges. And for cotton, for example, it's rallied to $1.80. The upper side of its long-term range was probably about a dollar, and that's likely to be a new floor for cotton. So the characteristic volatility and the cyclicality that we see in commodity prices isn't going to disappear, but there remains a strong likelihood that we're going to see progressions of higher reaction lows. We're going to see them when they do rally, that when they fall back, they're going to find support above their previous low. We're going to have incremental progressions of higher reaction lows, which are likely to be the hallmark of a secular bull market for just about all commodities, but particularly these food commodities. There's a lack of joined up thinking globally on increasing supply. And with the removal of subsidies, particularly in the USA and in Europe, that has, or it's not so much the removal of subsidies in Europe, but the changing of subsidies to be linked to the preservation of a rural life or or environmental concerns rather than the production of food, has changed, artificially changed the market environment. And we continue to see that there is no coordination globally for the production of food. And when food prices get to panicky levels, countries restrict supply. The world is completely it's completely possible to produce enough of food for everyone on the planet, but perhaps not at today's prices. And that is a measure that it has received very little commentary in various media, that there is no real coordination globally to provide enough of food and to keep food prices at a manageable level. And that being the case, we can expect to see regular spikes in food prices going forward. That isn't something that's likely to go away. The rising purchasing power of so many markets, particularly in the population centers of the world, means that not only do we have greater demand for food, but that there are more people who can afford to buy it. The emerging markets are now the center for global growth. They're some of the best-run countries in the world. They have some of the best fiscal positions. They have some of the least debt. They are some of the least indebted societies. The personal level of leverage is really quite low. The savings rates are high. So it really is a fallacy to refer to them as emerging markets. They're progressing markets. They've learned the lessons that needed to be learned following various crises, and the emerging markets have emerged. So the growth in the global economy is increasingly being led by those fiscally sound countries. They're also the ones that have the best demographics. So we are moving into very much a two-tier world where much of Europe and the USA is mired in debt and a low-growth environment as a result, whereas much of Asia and Latin America is high growth, has is beginning to harvest its demographic dividend, and has the potential to leverage up to promote economic growth for a considerable period of time. And it's those areas that are leading the way in terms of global GDP growth and the greatest urbanization in history, with hundreds of millions of people moving from an agrarian lifestyle to an urban lifestyle, that are helping to drive the global economy. That's where the opportunities are. That's the really big macro picture. And when it comes to shooting fish in a barrel, you want to find the barrel that's got the most fish, and you want to find a nice big gun. Well, the greatest urbanization in history is the big story, and there are a number of different ways to exploit it, because one can invest in commodities which benefit from the rise in demand. One can invest in globally oriented blue chips that can be pretty much listed anywhere, but are predominantly in the USA and in Europe, and that have leverage to global growth. Or one can invest directly into the respective stock markets. So there is no shortage of opportunities to benefit from this greatest urbanization in history, provided one is willing to accept that this is a long-term secular theme that probably has years, if not decades, left to run. Obviously, it'll be punctuated by occasional recessions, but those are likely to be major buying opportunities for those high-growth economies and should be viewed from that perspective. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, but wish all the best to all of you.